Welcome to the latest podcast from Bodywise, the Eating Disorders Association of Ireland. This episode features extracts from a lecture given by Mr. Kevin McCann, a practicing Gestalt psychotherapist from Tralee, County Kerry. The lecture, entitled Developing a Personal Relationship with Food, was presented by the Professional Cookery Students Institute of Technology in Tralee, County Kerry, and was advertised as being of interest to those who struggle with or support others in a professional capacity with food and body image issues. The audio you are about to hear is a selection of extracts from the lecture. Thank you for coming. I hope you get something out of tonight. I hope you're going away with a nugget of something. My aim is not to give you anything particularly too much, but if I can get you to go away with one nugget of a question about how you eat, I think I will have achieved something. What I hope to do tonight is to maybe just stir questions. What I'm interested in is stirring questions, not particularly in giving solutions, but simply to get us to question. And the big thing for me is not what we eat, but how we eat. So I'm more interested in how you do what you do and how much information you have about how you do it. And we're constantly being bombarded with what to eat. But rarely do you ever hear, how do you eat? And where did you learn to eat the way you eat? Now, as a Gestalt psychotherapist, we're mostly interested in not the what, but the how. How much information do you have about what you do? For example, you're having a real domestic at home, and the next thing, after 2 minutes, you're into the same row that you've had for the last 10 years. That never gets resolved. And somehow you're in it, and you don't know how to get here. Here we are, and we're back to square one again, or talking about the same thing again. That would suggest that there's not a lot of information about how you do what you do. So, whilst the biomedical model is in itself absolutely spot on, I would suggest to you that it's also incomplete, because it simply looks at what we eat, but it doesn't look at how we do it. And I want to look at tonight some of the ways in which we learn to relate to food as a relational medium. And all relationships have that ability to make contact and also to break contact. So what I'm really interested in is, how do you make contact with food and using food? And more importantly, how do you break contact? And where did you learn to eat the way you do, rather than what you eat? Because I'm assuming that for many of us, we all have that information. Yet, if all that information is out there in the environment, why then are all the food distress signals like overweightness, bulimia, anorexia, still prevalent and growing? So something must be missing. And I want to suggest that what, in my opinion, is missing is the whole relational aspect of food. And the first thing we normally come front when people come with food issues is that the word, or the concept of the word diet, is completely and absolutely lost. Most people you talk to, when you say about diet, it's about weight loss or weight gain. And that isn't what the word diet means. It has nothing to do with its original meaning, which is a way of life or a course of life, which comes from the Greek to make a choice. Yet nowadays, that word diet has become a loaded gun in terms of either weight loss or weight gain. And I want to suggest that we need to move away from this whole idea of being on a diet, yeah, or working with a diet, but more to look at, how am I relating to food from a relational aspect? What meaning making do I make from my relationship with food? And where did I learn to do that? And lots of the words that we use around food are totally misused. For example, constantly hear students and myself sometimes included, say, we're starving, yeah, or I've lost my appetite. Well, appetite is a funny word from a psychological perspective, because it doesn't always relate to food. The Three great Gestalt psychologists, Perls, Hevelin, and Goodman, said that appetite seems to be stimulated by something in the environment, something outside of ourselves, or it is to arise spontaneously in the organism, within ourselves. The appetite, however, is usually vague, and that's one of the most important statements they make. Appetite, by and large, in lots of cases, can be quite vague, until it finds some object to work on. It is the height of creative adjustment in the individual that heightens awareness of what one wants. So the question here is, what do you know about your appetite? And is your appetite always linked to food? Do you automatically assume that appetite links to food? You may have an appetite for something other. You might have an appetite to meet somebody, to be with somebody, to hear from somebody, to make physical contact with somebody. But automatically that word, like the word diet, has become synonymous with food. Hevelin, Perls, Hevelin, and Goodman would suggest that that's not always the case. That appetite has other meanings to us. And we need to be able to investigate two things. We need to be able to investigate our appetite, and we also need to investigate hunger. Definition of hunger, according to the Chambers Dictionary, is a craving for food, need or lack of food, a strong desire for anything, to crave food, to long for, or having a desire for food, and then, or anything else. And most of the time, we automatically assume that our hunger is food-based. But rarely do we investigate our hunger. And a non-investigated hunger is a hunger that leaves us sitting with emptiness. Because we constantly will fill that hunger using food, sex, gambling, alcohol, drugs, or work, or whatever, if it goes uninvestigated. And in many instances, from where knee-high, we're trained to automatically assume that hunger is food-related. It may or it may not always be. I simply pose the question, how much do you know of yourself about how you investigate your hunger? You might be hungry to be held. You might be hungry to be in contact with someone who's passed away. You might be hungry for a relationship that has broken up. You may be hungry for food. So what I try and do is to get people to begin to investigate their hunger. Later on, I present a model of relationship in human relationships that resembles this. What do we hunger from our partners from? And does that parallel how we also relate to food? The big question for me is, and I'm only throwing out lots of questions to sort of stimulate that you may go home and think about things. But a question is the way you relate to food the way you relate to people in human relationships? Does it have any parallel? And that's really worth investigating. That's a big question. So what do you know about your own hunger? And more importantly, what do you know about satisfying your hunger? Are you able to ask to get that hunger needs met? Are you shy about it? Do you overfill that hunger? Do you know when you've had enough? And do you know the history of your hunger? And of course, the big thing today is that we almost have an aversion to being hungry, as if it's something wrong with having a hunger. I certainly know when I was growing up, hunger was quite a normal experiential thing to have. You got your breakfast, you didn't get anything else until lunchtime, and you got nothing in between until tea time, and probably that was it. So in between times, you had some sense of hunger, and it was nothing to be frightened of. Whereas nowadays, hunger is seen as something that must be averted at all costs. So therefore, we don't get a chance to really investigate the existential hunger that may be there. A hunger to belong, a hunger to be heard, a hunger to be validated, a hunger to be seen in a big organization, a hunger to be appreciated for all the work that we do. So what other types of hunger do you know about? And most importantly, the question I want to pose for you is, do you know how you avoid your hunger? What do you do with it? Do you stay full all the time so that you don't have to feel it? And now, because we've become so wealthy, we can afford to eat 24/7. We have, you know, garages open 24 hours a day. So basically, our hunger needs can be met virtually 24/7. Another word that's constantly been used is starvation. It's used a lot as a weapon, as a form of self-inflicted pain, as a form of self-punishment. But it's a word that we use all the time, constantly. Our lads use it. I use it sometimes myself. Jeez, I'm starving. Well, and sometimes we say that people die of starvation. And we take it in all the time from the media. You know, there are so many people dying of starvation. You don't die of starvation, you die by it. And starvation is used as a mechanism to numb the phenomenological system. So once you go into starvation mode, you don't feel anything. It's actually numb. And people who work in famine situations will tell you that they're not even aware of their need for food. They've gone beyond it. They've moved on to another level. They don't even have a sense of wanting taste or wanting anything filled. It's about survival now at this stage. So that word starvation, again according to Chambers, it's a lean, hungry, weak, pining person, animal or plant. And to starve is to be in want, but also to deteriorate. And it's worth noting that people who go on starvation diets, people who starve themselves, and they wonder why, well, look, I'm starving and I'm nothing's happening. You know, I'm not losing anything, it's not working for me. It's important to note that what happens in those situations is that the body goes into survival mode. The whole metabolism slows down, so you're not going to lose weight if that's what you're trying to do. Lots of people, when we go on later on to talk a little bit about anorexia, will use starvation or will use overeating as a form of numbing the emotional system. The psychologist Dean Jade says, foods rich in sugar and fat causes surges in serotonin and the happiness neurotransmitters. Even starvation creates meaningful changes in mood that may transcend the pain of being hungry. So when you move into that space of starvation, there is no sense of hunger anymore. It's a different quality of pain. And it's got nothing to do with being hungry. So from that perspective, when we use those words, it's really important to be aware of their meaning. Because the language that we use in our outer world, in many instances, reflects the hunger on the inside. So people constantly saying, I'm starving. You may be experiencing some form of hunger, but I'd like for you to open up and see what that hunger might be. The next one we talk again about food is emptiness. People talk about emptiness a lot, or feeling emptiness, or a sense of emptiness. Particularly people who have what I'll go on to describe later on, a confluent relationship with food, where there's no boundary between the self and food. There's no distinction between the food on the plate and you, and they just constantly take in. And they constantly will say, alcoholics will say the same, drug addicts say the same. They're filling some emptiness, but they've no idea what the emptiness is because it's uninvestigated. It isn't being looked at. O'Leary, one of the big Irish Gestalt people at UCC, describes emptiness as a mechanism for avoiding what she calls the impasse. And the impasse is the point where you come to sometimes, you know, sometimes you have to make a decision and you don't know what to do. Or you experience some emotional turmoil and you want to get away from it. You'll do anything but look at it, or you'll do anything but talk about it, or you'll do anything but take it on. You'll try and get away from it all the time. And she says that for growth to occur, for somebody to really make a huge internal movement or to find out really what's going on for them, for growth to occur, it's essential that people stay with the void, that's the emptiness, in order to get through the impasse. So lots of people who struggle with food issues, it's really important that they stay with that emptiness. Investigate it. Ask it what's happening. What is it empty for? What is the food filling, or what are they using food to fill that they might want something else to fill? And it's only when you can get them to that point, particularly people who are self-destructive, they constantly miss this emptiness void. They're constantly finding ways. So they're constantly keep deflecting with food from that emptiness without investigating it and saying, what am I empty for? Another question, who am I empty for? And I'm only posing questions. Eckhart Tolle describes emptiness very, very well. You'll see this a lot when you go to supermarkets. A great way to see this now is to look at the supermarket trolleys. They're full. all your cupboards at home full. Full of gadgets. Full of machines. And you look at the trolleys now, and the trolleys are piled high. And we have this inner thing, this inner message that we have, what we call a psychological introject of not enough. That somehow what we have or who we are is not enough. And when you become identified, Eckhart Tolle, the philosopher, says, when you feel bored, you can satisfy the mind's hunger by picking up a magazine, making a phone call, switching on the TV, surfing the net, going shopping. And this is not uncommon. But transferring the mental sense of lack and its need for more to the body, and it's satisfying it briefly by ingesting more food. The other question is, by constantly having that sense of fullness, what emptiness are you avoiding? What guilt feelings might you be avoiding for the working mother who works very hard and comes home and doesn't have time to put a dinner on the table? What introjects, or in an introject, by the way, is some belief system that you've taken in that doesn't belong to you. It actually belongs to some other person or organisation, like being told to be a good girl all the time, not get angry, because girls don't get angry, or to be quiet, shut up and eat your dinner. That's an introject, which means that dinner parties become very difficult because you've learned from a very young age to stay quiet during dinner. So you don't say a lot until dinner's over. So lots of things like that are what we look at. So in terms of not being enough, I want you to look at less is more. But one of the big things is that we now are buying so much food and wasting so much food, it's actually frightening. Recent statistic I got from the States today. In 2006, last year, in the US, they wasted about 14% of their food. That accounts for $43 billion, is what was wasted. It's mostly wasted by overbuying to fill this emptiness or this need to have plenty. And it's wasted by overcooking and serving our portions too big. And how much do we know here about the plate piled high with spuds? Or as a Spanish friend of mine who lives in Milltown, and she said when she came to Ireland first about 12 years ago, and she'd said to people, you know, like a good restaurant or people were out on a Friday night, and she'd say, how was it? And they'd say, loads. Jesus, there was loads. And she'd say, how was the dinner? Christ, there was loads. We had a great night. And you know who we met there? And she said, I had to ask about four times, and she said, and how was the meal? That was grand. The meal was grand. What she wanted to know about was the quality. How was the quality of the food? And they equated quality with quantity. Now, Irish families create more than 36.5 tons of food waste a year. So that's what we're wasting in 2006, their last year's stats. We're actually dumping that from our fridges. Go home now and check your cupboards and see what's out of date. We dump it because we buy lots of stuff that is just not eaten, but we need to fill up the table. And we do it by serving portions that are too big that people can't actually eat what's on the plate. 25% of food waste is caused by households cooking more than they can eat or buying too much. And I believe that that too muchness is born out of a sense of not enough. And in many instances, that sense of not enough is where we replace food with love. And it's another expression, which I'm going to come on to later on, of where we show how we actually feel. So where does this relationship begin? If we're accepting the premise that the biomedical model is absolutely spot on, perfect, we need to know all about nutrition, we need to know our dietetics, you know, we need to know about our fats, our carbohydrates and our proteins. But most importantly, what we need to know is, what's your relationship like to your body? What do you know about what your body needs? And where did you learn, as a human being, how did you learn to relate to food? It actually begins in the womb. And I like to call this, it's the journey from the womb to the plate. And we move from a psychological position of being dependent on the external, which is the environment outside the womb, to feed us and to keep us alive in there, to relying on the mother's breast, the family table, and then out into the wider social world. So there's like four major stages of this. So that process is about moving from an environmental support, total dependence on the mother, and note we keep using the mother in this. Where's father? Where does he figure in this whole nurturing process? I want to come back to that later on. Because in many instances, once baby arrives, he isn't always included in the nurturing process. Which, of course, sends out big messages to men and big messages to women. Which we need to take a look at. So for many, this journey is never fully complete, especially males. So males are left totally dependent on the females for nurturing. A couple of years ago, I was down in the Grand Hotel, and this elderly couple, elderly meaning they were in their 90s, sat down at the next table, and Mary, who I know, came over to take the order, and she says, "What do you have, lads?" And he says to her, what am I having? And she said, "He's having the beef well done." And she was shouting, I couldn't help but hear it, you know. And she says, "Mash the spuds, he hates the roast potatoes." And he wanted the roast potatoes mashed. Your man had no idea of how to self-nurture. And now young fellas leave school, and young girls. They have no idea, from a psychological perspective, of how to support themselves in the world with nourishing themselves with food. So the idea here, what I'm trying to get you to look at, is how can we get food more into the relational sphere and see, how can I use this to support myself as a self-support mechanism? Because what messages does it send out that, is it only women who can do the nurturing? Is it only women who cook? This first relationship is really important, where the baby learns to make contact with its mouth. It gets really interesting here, because this is the first point of contact outside the womb. The newborn infant and the mother, that connection is absolutely vital here in terms of how do we learn to relate. So it's not what the child receives when it's born. It's how is that food presented? Is it presented with love and care? Is it presented with a certain amount of depression? Is it presented with a certain amount of aggression? Is it just, remember years ago when there was 9, 10, 12 in huge families and it was just another mouth to feed and God, there's another one? So it isn't so much how the baby receives, what the baby receives, it's how it's given. And the first point of contact here, the mouth, is the focus of the general approach to life. And Erickson made that point very, very clearly. Because the mother's breast to the child are life. That's how it sees its survival. So we learn to do lots of things at the very early stage with the tongue, with the lips. That's where we get our pleasure from. So it's our first point of sensual pleasure is the baby's lips on the mother's breast. So how that is managed is really important in setting up the first stages of the emotional relationship between self and food. New research coming out of the States by these fantastic, wonderful women in America who are doing marvellous research now on Gestalt and food. We now know about the fetal memory, yeah? And that the fetus in the womb, we now know, has the ability to perceive sounds, light, is capable of swallowing, tasting, reacting to bitter substances, making faces, dreaming, playing with umbilical cord, and showing intelligent behaviour. We believe that these behaviours are linked to the ability to adapt and conform to new situations, and to select conditions and profit from the experience, all of which imply learning and memory. So we know that even in the womb, the mother's relationship to food and the mother's relationship to how she eats is transferred to the baby in the womb. So if the mother is dieting on, you know, baked beans, sausages and chips, or fish fingers and whatever the case may be, and, you know, lots of fizzy drinks and all of that, that's all recorded in memory. And that is carried out on then to the next stage, which is where the child comes out into the world to receive some more nourishment. And that point is really important, because that's the first point where we begin to learn how to relate. The next stage is Freud's stage of oral development. Really important. In my opinion, it's probably the part of development less taught in most courses, particularly in counselling courses, is the part that's missed a lot. This whole part of what do we do with our mouth, our tongue, the ability to suck, the ability to become dependent on others. And if these needs are not fulfilled properly, the baby may become mistrustful, or if overfulfilled, may experience difficulty in coping with an environment that doesn't always meet his or her needs. So that very first early stage, from birth to about 18 months, the relationship between the child and the mother, or the child and the bottle, the child and the breast, is really important. How that is carried out sets the baby up for the next stage. So if the needs are overfilled, so every time the child cries, you just stick a bottle in its mouth, or you stick the dummy in. Well, Well, the message you're getting, well, every time you cry, the environment will keep giving you what you need. All you got to do is keep crying, or all you got to do as a child, then just put your hand up and you will get your needs met. Which sets them up, possibly, not always, and I'm just putting this out, these are all possibilities. I'm not saying anything sacrosanct, but they're areas worth investigating. It may set the child up to be quite dependent then on others and expect that you're just going to give me everything I need when I become an adult, and they become quite dependent. If that part gets really badly handled, we say that they get stuck at the oral fixated stage. Very much related to smoking. Very much related to heavy drinking. Very much related to people who don't know when they've had enough. They're really stuck back. Anything got to do with the mouth, generally, when you go to work with them psychologically, you start to question some of the early contact with food and mother and to see what happened back here. What are they still doing with their mouth that's giving them the pleasure from the drink, from the cigarette? Now, I'm not saying that all smokers here have difficulties, issues with their mother. But what I'm saying is it's worth noting and it's worth investigating just to see what's going on. So do we constantly take in liquids? Do we constantly keep our mouths full? Do we need to keep chewing the gum? People constantly chewing gum. The next stage in which we move on to. Now, we could spend 3 days just talking about the oral stage and how important that is. At least 3 days. At least three. But the next stage is the family meal experience. In my opinion, probably one of the most important stages there is in human development in terms of our relationship to food. And this is where the how comes in. This is where the how really comes in. What was your family meal table like? What was it like to be at your family meal table? Do we have family meal tables anymore? How many people actually spend time sitting at a family on a regular basis, being together as a family and using food as the medium? Or has it become, Jesus, Coronation Street's on, let's hurry up quick. Who's filling the dishwasher? Hurry up there, John. Come on, finish that there now. We have to go out, or you have to go to ballet, or you have to go to horse riding and blah, 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 and you have to do all that there. And there's no time to actually sit. Or are you eating and watching TV at the same time? Because if you are, you're out of body contact. You have no idea what's happening phenomenologically for you if you're trying to watch the TV with your eyes and eat with your mouth. So what do we tell kids when they're sitting there watching TV and munching the stuff and they're really engrossed in the TV and what's going into their mouth is being lost completely? They have no sense of taste and they have no sense of what is the phenomenological experience of what's just happening. They've missed it because they're focused here. Now, the family meal table, it says here, is a classroom. It's a microcosm of society with its own laws, expectations, self-restraint, sharing, consideration, taking turns, and the art of conversation. The question I want to pose to you from tomorrow. I want you to look tomorrow, or the next time you're eating at work, and see how you are when you go to eat lunch with your colleagues. And notice, what do you notice about yourself? Do you go into the same mood as you did when you were a little boy or a little girl at the family dinner table? Are you able to ask for more? Do you sort of wait and say, no, it's okay? Do you make sure the men get bigger portions than you do? They have to be fed first. And don't always assume that the family meal table was a good experience. For some, it's probably the worst place on earth they could have been as children. For some, it's the place where war breaks out the minute they all sit down to eat. And mommy and daddy start going at each other and the child is sitting there going, oh God. So rather than get involved in this war that's going on, particularly when separation is coming up, or in areas of domestic violence. This is a big issue for people who work with people who suffer domestic violence. So if there's war going on at the table, the child says, it's better to keep eating than say anything. I should keep my mouth shut, keep stuffing it here with food, and say nothing. And so as adults, they'll learn to just eat everything on the plate. They'll just clear the plate all the time without question whether they actually want to eat it or not. Or that old messages, I'm not too sure if we still get these messages anymore, but that old message, look what's happening in the rest of the world, they have nothing to eat, you should be damn glad to have it. None of you heard that one? So you're immediately saying, oh God, you know, they work very hard for your mother. Or you've rushed home from a hard day at the office, and you're having time, and you know, you just put up the quickest meal you can get, and they say, I don't want that. And then all hell breaks loose. Do you know how hard I work? Do you know how hard your father works? I'm only home. I have to rush out at 8 o'clock to a meeting. Eat it. And you go, okay. Now, we call that a perfect example of an interject. It means I'm going to eat it now, whether I actually want it or not, because a child will do anything rather than upset the mother or father. So generally, they'll say, okay, I'll take that in. So immediately, we have a body split. There is no sense of, do I really want this, or will I eat it because she's getting really upset, and I don't want to upset mommy. So that, what goes on at the dinner table, is absolutely vital. Were there rules at that dinner table? Could you leave before the meal was over? Did you have to wait till daddy got up? Could everybody leave before he got up? Or how did you speak at the table? Was it speak only when you're spoken to? Eat your dinner in silence? Or was conversation encouraged? Were you allowed to leave some stuff on the plate? If you didn't like something, was it forced down your throat? That's a very interesting one, by the way. People who generally do this, for example, they go to express an opinion over the dinner table and say, shut up, eat your dinner. The child is trying to say something, maybe really important. I've had a nice day at school, or look, I had a run-in with the teacher, or Johnny stole my pocket money, or I'm not really happy. You know, a whole load of things. And said, shut up and eat your dinner. And then the TV switched on, and there's no room for the child to express an opinion. Another example of that early relationship around the table, I'll give you an example. People who play with their food. You know, they don't really know what they want, and they move the food all over the plate. A couple of years ago, I done this workshop in London. I want to say that tonight is only part of a preliminary 2-day experiential workshop that I do. So I would use this the night before to get people's awareness of. A very famous artist who learned to create art from coming from a very violent background at home, and who spent most of his time moving the food all around the plate, and in his head creating the most amazing abstract shapes with food, because he was too scared to lift the fork. Later on in life, discovered in his mid-30s that he had a wonderful ability to create the most amazing art. So lots of things happen around the family table. For example, I'm just throwing out some stuff to stimulate. Do you always sit in the same place all the time at work? That's my seat. I worked one time for a religious order. They had a thing about their position at the table, this hierarchical position, you know? One day, this young curate came in, not knowing the rules around this table, and this rather robust parish priest was sitting at the end. He took your man's seat. Your man walked in, grabbed a stale bread roll from the bread basket, and he belted it off your man's head, and insisted that he get up and give him his seat. It became a position of power at the table. So lots of what we learn how to be as adults in the world, and most of this stuff is out of awareness. We're going through our lives totally out of awareness. We're doing things, but we don't know how we're doing them. So we end up, the plate's empty. Do you always clear the plate? Yeah. Do you always leave the table that quick? Yeah, I just finish in 2 minutes. I woof it down. Where did you learn to woof your food down? I don't know. I've always done it. Did you ever question it? No. Would you like to question it? Have a look at that. Was it safe to spend time at your table and talk and relax and chat with mum and dad? Or was it, look, get this in me and get out of here quick, because them two are going to start. Or the big fella's going to start. So immediately there's no relationship with the food. The food and you are split. And there's nothing to relate to. Now, you can talk all the dietetics you want about that. That's not going to solve a problem with someone who really struggles with a relationship with food like that. We need to get them back into a healthy relationship with food. And first, they might have to start talking about some stuff that they don't really want to talk about. Okay, food, time and family. Longer working hours and more time spent travelling means that cooking at home has declined. In the US, the average cooking time for the evening meal in the 50s was 2 hours. It's now 15 minutes. Notice two things are happening. Everything on the outside of ourselves is becoming faster, and everything outside of ourselves is becoming slimmer. Anybody know the work of Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect? That Bauhaus movement in Germany with those slimline houses, those perfect slimline houses, the thinner mobile, the plasma screen TV. There's a whole movement external to us that wants everything slim, that it'll fit into a nice little pocket someplace. And there is something going on at a psychological level that we want to push out and expand and rebel against that sense of being constricted into something smaller. So I believe that there's something bigger happening in the human psyche that is rebelling and saying, I'm not having this. I'm not going to be compressed anymore. Offices get smaller. Have you noticed that? The workspace seems to be getting smaller all around. A big computer in the corner, and then everything is small. And somehow, I believe we're reacting to that. Now, if it has fallen to 15 minutes, where is the ability then to learn all those social skills, the rules of engagement, the rules of conversation, the rules of challenging? Have you ever noticed that at work? And at the staff meeting? I'll tell her no tomorrow. I'll tell you we'll go to that meeting tomorrow. We'll have all this here. And you, when you sit down and you say, how's it going? Well, where did all that go? Or you're walking down to the boss's office. You say, not that timetable now.
So we wouldn't know nothing about that, sure.
No. Or you're going down to the rise and you're on the way down to have a big chat and then all of a sudden look. And you swallow. And you go, I'll do that tomorrow. I'll talk to her tomorrow. And you've learned how to swallow your feelings. You've learned how to swallow your emotions. Have you heard that one? You swallowed your words. And you do it with food. So not only with what's coming up, but with the swallowing, we need to look at, what are you swallowing when you swallow like that? Or what are you swallowing when you take your food in big chunks? Do you ever notice that? Some people just take big chunks in their... And there's a very interesting thing in Gestalt. We look at how people take in that food. And do they chew it? Do they actually chew their food? Do they think about what they're tasting? Do they allow themselves to phenomenologically experience that chewing? Or do they just take a big chunk and go? How many people do that? And is that what you learned to do as a kid? We say people like that, and I'm generalizing, are quite gullible. They'll swallow anything. You'll get them to swallow anything. And the bigger the chunk, the more they'll swallow. So they don't chew things. They don't say, do I like that? So when a child says no, it means no. I was in a restaurant recently and there was a couple with a child in a high chair. They were feeding the child. The child was very clearly with its body language saying no. They kept moving the head and putting the teaspoon in. The child was very clearly saying, look, can't take it in, it's too fast. I have enough. Another example of a body split. The only thing a child can do in that instant is to split from its body phenomenology, which means that I can't feel now what's happening, so I'll just let them stuff everything into me. They weren't listening. They weren't reading what the child was saying. It was very clearly saying, I've had enough, give me a break, let me slow down. And they were rushing like mad to get out of the restaurant. And the most interesting thing was that when mother had finished and she couldn't get it into him, she turns around, she said, so here, you give it to her. It was awful. First set of a mind-body split in terms of food. So, we look at nurturing. And that whole process, we know that boys are generally breastfed for longer than girls. Boys are weaned a little bit more slowly. So boys learn a lot of the time. Mothers, we also know, use different words for boys than they do for girls. We know, therefore, that boys learn a lot about receiving, but not a lot about giving or showing affection. Typically within families, boys are not provided with much-needed opportunities to take on the responsibilities that involve tenderness and nurturing. So from a very early age, we're training the men to be dependent on women and say, well, you do all the nurturing now. You do all the providing of the food and the nourishment. And sure, I'm helpless. She's no that, sure. Men can't do that sort of stuff. So what I want to look at here is that ability for men to become self-nurturing and how to get them involved in the nurturing process when baby's born. In making the bottle, in heating up the bottle, in just sitting with mother when mother's feeding. So that they're not excluded, and so that children from a very early age learn that men can also nurture, and we actually nurture very well when we're given the chance. But in many instances, particularly in lots of Irish families, the job is done, lads, when the baby arrives. It's all over. We have nothing more to do. And it's like, bring home the bacon, somebody do the cooking, put the meal up on the table, and say no more about it. And the message that we're getting is that boys don't nurture, so therefore we don't learn how to cook. Now, I want to go into a little bit here about procedural memory. This is how you do what you do. Anybody here tie shoes in the morning? Are you aware of what you're doing when you tie your shoes? Or do you just tie them? You just go out the door. Well, that's procedural memory. Procedural memory is when you've learned to do something and it gets programmed into the procedural way of doing something. The same thing happens with food. If I learnt at my family table to gobble everything down really quickly, or if I learnt at my family table only to eat half what's on the plate because I was really upset and I always give half to my sister, do you ever think what's been passed from my plate to yours? I'm really upset because he's shouting at her again. Or they're all crying at the table, or they're really fighting at the table, or there's stone silence and I'm really nervous and I can't eat my meal, and then I give you half because I've had enough. That goes into what we call procedural memory. And so every time you sit at a table, you'll keep doing the same thing over and over again until somebody brings it to your attention. An example, same workshop in London a couple of years ago, a lady who was in the experiential group said she wanted to eat lunch late. She didn't want to go with the group to the restaurant. I found it fascinating how she didn't want to go. So I called her and said, you know, what's wrong? Is it you don't want to be with the group? Or is it something I said? Did I upset her? Do you know? And she said, no, noise. She didn't like noise. She said she only liked to go to restaurants that were very quiet. So she would go just before they opened and got busy, or at the end when everything was over, and she'd always eat. And she had no idea why. It was something she'd always done, never questioned it. That's just what she'd done. And to her, it was just like a life choice. This is what I do. I like the nice quiet. She'd bring a book and she'd read. And I thought about it, I said, there's more to that than meets the eye. I just thought, I just got a hunch, you know. So when the workshop was finished, I said, you know, have a chat. We were sitting down over a cup of coffee talking. And what emerged was, after about a half an hour of chat, was that she realised that at home, war would break out at the family dinner table, and there would be screaming and roaring. And the noise used to drive her crazy. So she used to hide a lot of the time underneath the stairs. And it was only when we started to talk about it that she realised that when noise levels would go up, even in a bar or in a restaurant, she would get really panicky. But she had no idea. She actually just thought she had a social phobia, you know, a bit panicky in places. But it was the noise level that used to send her into this procedural memory thing that she had to get away each time. So she kept avoiding noisy restaurants. And procedural memory is, if I learn to eat in a certain way as a child, I will continue to do that into adulthood unless somebody brings it to my attention. Unless somebody says, what are you doing and how do you do it? Like, for example, food memories. Golda Meir, the Israeli president, talked a lot about food memories. That even when she was president of Israel, every time she was given a meal, even at a state banquet that contained anything that looked like gruel, she would go straight back to the ghetto. It's up here. She would go straight back into the ghetto. And she described in one interview that she'd done that she was talking to one of the French presidents, having this big intellectual discussion about world politics. But in actual fact, she said, in her head and in her body, she was actually perspiring at this whole memory because the sweet that they gave her looked quite similar to gruel. And she had been transported right back to the ghetto. And lots of times the food that we eat triggers memories. For example, I bet everybody sitting here has a favourite food memory. When they were kids, when you were sick, and what you got when you were sick. Apple crumble is mine. Rhubarb crumble and custard. Now, some memories are good and some memories are bad. And lots of times people will avoid certain foods because those foods carry memories. Or a smell can trigger something. Go, oh, Jesus, yeah, do you remember that we used to have that as kids? And then that could lead you into a whole other world. So you'll avoid certain foods because the smell might trigger something other than that. Now I want to explain a little bit about Gestalt before I go on to bulimia, anorexia. In Gestalt, we talk about a process of making contact and withdrawing. For example, lots of people are in relationships, but they're not relating. Anybody that does couples work will let you know that very, very quickly. And they'll say, we're together 10 years, I know nothing about him. And he say, and I know nothing about her. But we're in a relationship, but they're not relating. Or they'll say, we don't know how to relate anymore. And lots of people are eating, but they're not relating to what they're eating. So they have a relationship with food, but they're not relating to the food. In Gestalt, what we look at is, we look at the process of how something emerges in you, how you satisfy that need, and how you move on to something else. A classic example would be sitting on the train, going to Dublin, you need to go to the loo, you're reading a book, and all of a sudden the need to go to the loo becomes more important than reading the book. You can't concentrate on the book anymore. I just need to go to the loo. You go, do your biz, you come back, you can concentrate on the book. You have a need fulfilled. That is what we would call a complete Gestalt. Now, a Gestalt can last a second, a couple of weeks, when maybe you're working through something at work, a process at work, or a Gestalt can become a lifetime. It can become a lifetime of undoing something that happened very early on, and you spend your rest of your life trying to rectify it. When we look at gestalt, we look at the undifferentiated field, which means it's very rare that that happens, unless you're in a state of meditation, that you actually are not aware of having any need. It's where the body is absolutely calm, there's no energy arising, you don't have any need to fulfill, and you're just mono. The next thing here is what we call the figure formation. Something comes up. I feel hungry. So the figure rises. Up it comes. I start to feel hungry. Now, if I don't investigate that figure, it's what we call sharpening the figure. If I don't look at the figure and say, well, what am I hungry for? Who am I hungry for? What's really going on? Then I'll just satisfy the need and move on to something. Generally, what we do is, the normal thing is we look out into the environment, we see what's available, can I satisfy this need? We satisfy the need, we move on, the need dies down, we find resolution, and we assimilate. Now, unfortunately, with the diet industry, there's nothing to assimilate. It's just another diet. But there's nothing psychologically to take in to say, I now have this internalized framework of reference that I can work from when I go to relate to food. So what we try and do with gestalt is to get the individual to see, well, what happens to you when you're hungry? What happens to you when you want to binge? What's going on when you want to throw up? What happens to you when you're starving? What happened before you made the decision, I am not going to eat? So we need to look at what is happening in the figure. What is the need that's not been investigated? In many instances, we move over to this place here. We try to get them to eat better. We try to work with the diet only. Now that's important. The nutrition aspect is vitally important. But if we work at this end only of the scale, we don't see what's happening at what we call the figure stage. So what is happening just before you throw up, before you put your fingers down your throat? What's happening in your head? What's happening in your body? What's going on inside you at that particular time? So that means slowing the process down and getting people aware. In lots of cases, they're not aware because they're disconnected from their body, or because they'll say to you, I'm sure you've heard this one before. Alcoholics use it quite a lot. Oh, I just ended up in the bar and there's a pint right in front of me. Can you understand what I mean? So if someone says, oh, well, I just cleared the plate and then I got sick. Well, you need to say, well, what was going on before you cleared the plate? What was going on at the figure stage? Now, if I work over here and say, well, maybe we work with smaller portions. Maybe we'll take you off the carbohydrates. That will work for a while. Absolutely, it will work for a while. But it won't get to the core of what's happening at the figure formation stage or the energy that's coming up in the body. It misses it completely. There's nothing for the individual to psychologically integrate, and there's no scaffolding from which to work. So the diet might work for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, then there's a big major upheaval, big emotional upheaval, and right back to square one, they're back to the plate again. That's a little bit about gestalt. I want to say a little bit here about this whole area of looking at food disorders. I don't believe that food is the disorder. I believe that the disorder is in the organism. An organism from a gestalt perspective means the person. So it's not in the environment. If we look outside the person, we miss the point. There's something, what we call diseased, or some people call it, I like to call it an unease. There's something uneased, or there's something diseased. Dis means disassociated from the sense of ease in the body. That the person is using food as a red flag to say, something wrong here. I want to draw your attention to the fact that I have a distress inside. I could do it with work. I could do it with gambling. I could do it with alcohol. I could do it with drugs. I could do it with religion. So there's many different pathologies that will try and draw attention to say there's something going on here, and I don't have the language, or I don't have the words to be able to tell you what's going on inside me. But I'm going to use food to do it, and I'm hoping to God that somebody's going to pick up on it and say, what's going on? So, but we keep talking about food disorders. There's nothing disordered about the food. It's a distress signal. So I want to look at obesity, bulimia, and anorexia in terms of a gestalt relationship issue. Because all behavior has meaning. And we need to try and get behind all the behavioural stuff, whilst it's really important, and I'm not knocking any of the behavioural stuff, it's important. But we need to go the next level down and see what meaning is that individual making about that relationship with the food. Now, people lots of times say they're on a self-destruct button. Well, we need to look at what do they know about the self-destruct button? How is it getting them the attention that they want to get? And what attention is it they're trying to bring us to? That's the big issue. We can work with all the diets in the world, and they'll work for a while. But unless we get underneath and see what's so important to this person. So if someone says, I'll give an example later on, but if someone says to me, you know, I'm just refusing to eat, my first response is, well done. You've found some way of drawing my attention. It's pretty self-destructive, but you've found some creative way of trying to draw the environment's attention to say there's something wrong with you. Now, let's sit down and talk about it. Rather than say, well, you need to get food into you, which is back here at the simulation stage. You know, you need to start eating more of this and more of that and blah, blah, blah. They already know all that. What they're saying is, I know it. I want to draw your attention to something at a deeper level. So, what I want to look at is particularly, let's look at relational issues. What's the relationship to the fat? What would the fat say if I got the fat to talk?
That's a different one now. Let's say he's lost his marbles.
What meaning does that individual make with the fat? How important is it to them? What is its purpose here? Now that's the question I like to ask when I work with Gestalt. Because I already know that they've heard it a million months time. You need to lose weight. Tell me something I don't know. You need to put on weight. Tell me something I don't know. Why am I coming to see you? So normally, if someone comes and says, look, I'm anorexic or I'm bulimic, I generally say, well, you found yourself into my room. Now let's talk about it. So it's not the fat that's the issue. It's the relationship with the fat. What's it doing on this particular body? What's its purpose? Is it to stop something getting out? Or is it to stop something coming in? What's it doing? What's the padding for? And how well padded are you in other areas of your life? How close do you let people in? Work with the polar opposite. Always go to the polar opposite and see, well, what is it they're trying to get away from? Because that is really important. One time, working in Cork on a training group and working with an anorexic individual, and what I noticed was not anything about her but about me, in that I felt huge. I knew that wasn't how I was, so I feel absolutely enormous. And in Gestalt we just go with whatever is. I just happened to say it. I said, you know something, I feel absolutely huge and you look so tiny to me. That was exactly what she wanted. The thought of her being big, terrified, absolutely terrified that she would have to stand up and become big. So being small was really, really important to her. She was avoiding the polar opposite. And she had been on every build-up diet in the world, and they hadn't triggered what was going on. So we also need to look at when the bulimic puts out the vomit, and we all work trying to get them to stop the vomiting. But let's look at the vomit. Yeah? So bulimia comes in and says, I feel I'm getting sick. Tell me, what are you giving back to the environment? What introject are you giving back to the world that says, I'm sick and tired of everybody telling me what to do? I've swallowed everything all my life and I'm sick of it. And I want to tell you how pissed off I am, but I don't have the language to do that, so I'm just going to puke it out every time. And does the relationship that the bulimic has with food match the relationship she has or he has with other people? Do they take in and then push them back out again? Because the bulimic is actually quite good at getting the figure. Do you remember the figure? They're quite good at, you know, feeling hungry and taking it in, but they can't hold the nourishment. They're not able to sustain it. They're not able to integrate it because it's other levels. There are other interjects that might say you don't deserve it, you're not smart enough, you're not good enough. What might happen if you really became nourished and nurturing? The answer is not in changing the food pattern. If I go to the end of the scale and start force feeding and all of that, I miss the point. We need to develop a dialogical relationship. That is the challenge. How can I get that individual to start talking about it.
It's really, really, really important.
D.H. Lawrence talks about this when he says we're not a mechanism, we're not an assembly. And it's not because the mechanism isn't working that I am ill. I'm ill because of the wounds to the soul and a deep emotional self. And so we need to look at the emotional aspect as well as the behavioural. So we need to look at the pathology, and we also need to look, well, what's going on underneath? How come none of the diets have worked? How come everything else has failed? What's going on underneath? How come you're not responding to treatment and everyone else is? What responsibility do you play in this when all the people around you are supporting you? What's going on in you? And don't be afraid. I always tell people when I do training groups, I guess, don't be afraid to challenge it. Because what's the first instance you see with someone who's particularly chronic anorexic? Oh, you'll upset me now. You know how weak I am? And you'll be saying, and I get very upset. If you get upset, how would you be? I could get a bit angry now, so. Or I would cry. Yeah? Apart from crying, what else do you do well? What do you mean, what else do I do well? Well, I know you cry very well, but what else can you do well? And you need to really keep challenging them. Because there's a vested interest in the anorexic at some level in staying small and not being big and staying fragile rather than strong. And we need to look at that because it works for them. It actually works at some level. The same with being quite large works, and it has a function and it has a meaning, and the bulimic has a function and has a meaning. When we look here at the figure, the anorexic has a vested interest from a theoretical perspective. And again, I'm putting this in the context that this is not sacrosanct. Every individual who seeks help for an eating issue has a personal history, they have a personal story, they have a personal experience, and I am not the expert. Anyone who tells them they're an expert is doing a disservice. I don't know what their experience is. I'm curious to know what their experience is, but I don't know exactly what's going to fit this individual when they walk in the door. But I'm curious to know what has their experience been around food. But the anorexic has a vested interest in not allowing the figure to form. They don't want any needs to arise. They don't want any energy to come up that they might have to deal with. Well, okay, I'll start eating food. Okay, I'll start recognizing my hunger. What else are you hungry for? So if I allow myself to say, well, I'm going to start taking in food and I'm going to start nurturing myself, what else might you take in? And by this statement that you're going to remain thin, what are you avoiding? The big question you must always ask is, what are you avoiding by being this way? What is the alcoholic avoiding by constantly being drunk? What is the workaholic doing? Big one for men. We're all trained to be, you know, big workers. Well, what are we avoiding when we constantly work the hours that we work? What price do we pay when we come home at 7 o'clock? Zonked. So the anorexic has an invested interest in not allowing a figure to form. Because then they won't have to look to the environment to get their needs met, and they won't have to take in and find resolution for themselves. And that's really important. And the one thing that I always do, it says here, the anorexic then is in a psychological bridging mechanism designed to provide some way of connecting to the world. They're trying this mechanism to say, I need to tell you something. I want to tell you what's going on in my inner world. I want to bridge out into this outer world, and I'm trying to do this to my body so that you pay me some attention so that I can find a mechanism to tell you. This having been said, we need to confront the question as to why the anorexic woman feels herself to be so deeply unentitled, rejected, inadequate, bad, impure, and sullied. These are the questions we need to ask, and also the anorexic male. So let's not be under any illusion that most food distress signals are female-orientated only. There's a lot of men out there who struggle with food issues, but they hide it incredibly well because it's seen as not gender specific, and you know, men aren't supposed to struggle with food. You know, that's a woman's thing. And you know, how would it be for a man to walk in and say, actually I'm quite anorexic or I'm bulimic? There's more shame attached to it. Yeah? So when we look at anorexic, we need to look at that. These are the questions that we need to be asking. In terms of bulimia, what we need to look at, again, the figure forms. They actually do allow themselves to take in the food. They do allow themselves to swallow. But then they give it back to the environment. And like its sister syndrome of compulsive eating anorexia, it's undoubtedly an alternative response by women or men to the conditions of their upbringing in a wider social world. And that really begins in teenage years, when girls really struggle, or young boys really struggle, when everything on the outside socially says you need to be thin, and inside your body's expanding. There goes the immediate struggle. What do I do now? Mobiles get slimmer. Everything else is getting slimmer. The media tells me I should be this size. All the clothes are cut to this size. What pressures are people under to say, well, this is how I should be? The human essence has been lost. And people are placing their value system on their body image rather than on their body essence. And who they are as that spiritual human being. And they define themselves by their shape. We define ourselves by the 4x4. We define ourselves by our career. We define ourselves by what part of town we live in. And we miss the point completely. And we define ourselves by our body shape. In terms of the compulsive eater, in terms of food addiction, this is where the food addiction comes in. A constant compulsion to eat. The experience of eating while fraught with anxiety contains elements of soothing. And the impulse towards food is generally coupled with a desire to give to oneself, to quiet an upset, or to make whole what is empty, or to say what cannot be spoken. So we keep stuffing the mouth constantly with food. We're constantly nibbling. We're compulsively eating. We have no awareness of, am I really hungry? Is that what I really want? But we just keep doing it and doing it. Like the alcoholic just keeps drinking, but has no idea of, yeah, what it is that they're actually numbing. What's actually going on. Now here, there's a pretty strong link here to depression and also in areas of domestic violence. So for lots of women who experience domestic violence, their only friend is food, their only comfort is food, it's the only thing we have. And particularly as people get older as well, food becomes even more important that way. Food and body, big issue, huge issue in terms of any of these distress signals. What's your body insecurity? The question I'm going to ask every one of you. And I ask all of these questions of myself. I wouldn't ask anybody else or somebody I work with any question that I wouldn't be prepared to ask myself. Yeah? And that is, what's the dialogue? What is the internal dialogue between head and body? So you stand in front of the mirror and you go, oh, jeez, look at the state of that. So, well, what do I do with that when somebody comes to me for an issue around a food issue? Or somebody comes and says, you know, I'm not too happy with my body. Because a lot is about, well, what do you know about your body? What relationship do you have with it? So how can you sit with somebody else when they're struggling with theirs and what meaning they're making out of that? Because we can only bring the person we're working with to the same stage of development that we ourselves are at. We can't bring them one inch further. It's not possible. Now, you may do it theoretically, but do you think people are stupid? How many times have you gone to talk to somebody and you say, they were listening, but they didn't have a clue what I was talking about. They kept nodding and going, yeah. But they really didn't know. And then you go and you say something to somebody and they immediately make the contact and you say, yeah, they knew. They knew exactly what was happening for me. So in terms of body, the body insecurity that we experience as an adult, we pass on to our children. The child lives in a body that's changing. The child has to adjust and to cope with these changes while facing the daunting psychological task of absorbing confusing parental messages about their bodies. And so a cycle continues. Now, if I'm not happy with it, and my son or daughter starts on a bit of weight and stuff, and I go, oh, Jesus Christ, you hype, get on a diet too quick, you want to go to the gym. I was recently in a gym, it was about 2 years ago, two young girls.
That actually wasn't meant as a joke, believe it or not.
And two young girls were on the bikes beside me, and I heard one say to the other, how many is that?
I said, yes, that's interesting.
And then afterwards, the other one says, I've 75 done, how many have you? Then I realised they were counting calories. Yeah. You know, on the bike, you know, they count your calories.
Girls, what are you doing?
And one little girl said, she said, oh no, she's doing her communion and she's to lose weight to get into the dress. So I called the girl and I said, get them out of here. They already had such insecurity around their little bodies. Do you know, it was just unbelievable. And to get into the shape that is, you know, set outside themselves, they were going to squeeze themselves into this dress. They already had a real serious issue with body. Yeah? And I guarantee you food. So, unless you're happy with your own body, regardless of what the shape is, you'll never be able to either lose or gain. So people say, I'm really stuck, I really need to lose weight. First thing I say is, welcome the weight. Welcome to it. Bring it in. It's here for a reason. The only way you're going to lose this, if you really want to lose it, is to welcome it in first. It's called the paradoxical theory of change. Accept what is, and it can change. I want to lose the weight, and I'm really angry with it. It ain't going to go anywhere until you actually say, welcome. Now we can work with it. Now we can have a dialogue, and we can go into relationship with it. So the corporally uncertain child becomes the corporally uncertain adolescent. The adolescent then becomes the adult. And then it becomes the parent who breeds more body insecurity, making them prey for the victims of fashion industry and the diet industry. So we're told that the belly top, you have to get into the belly top. So then they become victims. They have no sense of body. A body is formed, or body identity is formed outside the self. It's been shaped by the environment, but it's not been shaped by the individual. So in their heads, they have some sense of what the perfect body is. And a good way to do it is to get people to say, tell me what your perfect body image is. Is there such a thing? Is it achievable? What is it? What is the perfect body? No, get them to walk in their perfect body. And then get them to walk in their imperfect body and see where are the messages. So, from this statement, what I'm trying to get you to look at is that the relationship between food and body is absolutely central. And unless you're happy with your own body, you're going to be in trouble. What we really need to do is we need to create an environment for our children that encourages them to trust their own appetites from the inside, not from the outside. So telling a child, eat your greens or eat your red cabbage, and the child says, I don't like that. You eat it because I made it for you. Or we tell the kids, you're having chicken nuggets and chips, and myself and your father are going in now to have a steak. Yeah? We need to get children to be able to appreciate their own appetites from inside their bodies, not from outside. We need to get them to develop that sense of appetite. And we can try to convey to them unambiguously that their bodies are safe to live in. That they don't become disconnected from their own body phenomenology. Susie Orbach, and if you're interested, she's the best writer, one of the best writers on food. She says, we eat when the clock says it's time. How many times do we do this one? Or when she's angry, tired or lonely, she complains that she's not experienced genuine hunger sensations for years. To the extent that people are alienated from their physical self, they will interpret sensation falsely. So we eat every night at 6. You have to, because Carnation Street is on. The minute you disconnect from body sensation, you will have no idea of how to interpret your hunger. You will have no idea of how to interpret your appetite, because you're disconnected from the body phenomenology. And we spend somewhere in the region of billions and billions and billions of dollars. What we need to move to is we need to move from a position of not constantly, and I'm not knocking the whole theory of looking at what we eat, that's vital. You know, we need to look at the whole nutrition and diet aspect. But the point that's constantly missing in all government responses in the Western world, and we will throw hundreds of thousands at trying to look at obesity, bulimia and anorexia, and we look at it totally from a cognitive position, and we will miss the vital link, which is how do you do what you do. So it's like giving up cigarettes and then 3 years later back on them again and say, how did that happen? I don't know. So what we need to look at is getting individuals to know, how do you do what you do? How do you go from a position of contact and then into process? Polster and Polster state the following. We've reached the point where taste has been sacrificed to the considerations of convenience and profit. The trouble is that once one surrenders the simplistic art of basic taste contactfulness available in tasting food, it is only a short step to devaluing contactfulness generally. So the minute we lose that basic ability to taste food, to go to the market and to smell the fresh vegetables, the fruits, to actually feel them, to touch them, to smell them, to have a sensual body relationship with them, then the ability to make human contact is seriously diminished. They quoted that back in the 60s. And what they're really saying is that the first point of human contact is the ability to taste. Now, the blocks to making that contact are really important. Those blocks in a Gestalt perspective are what we call introjects, projections, deflections, confluence, and retroflection. Retroflection is when somebody holds something in. So they eat until they're full and then they hold it. They're not giving up. Okay? The person who's confluent has no idea of where a confluent relationship is a very codependent one. I hate that word codependent, but it's sort of that pop psychology babble that people use. You know, it's where there's confluence, where there's no immersion of two separate figures. And one lives behind the other. Like, they always use the word we. How was your holiday? Oh, we always go to Spain. Where'd you go Friday night? We always go to the Tankard. And we always have the same thing. And what would you like? I don't know, Johnny has that, and sure, I have whatever Johnny's having. Would you like to have something different? I don't know, sure, I'll have it. I'll just have what he's having, sure, it's easy. Totally confident. No idea of needs at all. Deflection, here you go. Look, I've had enough. Take some of that. We keep deflecting. And lots of times we use language to deflect, or we use food to deflect. So we just keep eating when we're actually feeling something quite upsetting. And these are some of the ways in which we do that with food. Now I want to take a look at this in terms of relationship. So if we look at alcohol, drugs, any of these issues, but particularly food, and if you start looking at it from a relational perspective, you might have just another cog in the wheel. I'm not saying it's the complete answer. Nothing is complete. Anybody that says they've got the complete answer, big question mark. I don't have it. I think anybody has. But I certainly believe that this is the big missing link when we look at bulimia, when we look at anorexia, and when we look at food compulsion and food addiction, and when we look at alcohol. It's what is relationally going on. So when couples come for therapy, I use exactly the same model. Now, isolation, very few people actually are isolated. You know, very few people can't make some sort of contact. Even those with severe mental illnesses, they can make some sort of contact. But very few people live in a world where they cannot make some contact with something outside of themselves. Yeah? From a relational perspective, we look at starvation. Now that means that there's no sense of any figure. There's no sense of any need emerging. There's just nothing happening. Yeah? We then go on to hunger when the need when the hunger begins to rise. 9 times out of 10, it's uninvestigated. If you really want to experience your hunger, you need to come into your body. It's not in the plate. It's not in Tesco. It's not in the supermarket. You need to investigate your hunger and notice, what is it? What am I hungry for? So when we feel that hunger, we need to go inside and see, what am I hungry for? Is it food I'm hungry for? Is it contact? Is it somebody that I'm missing? You know, would a glass of water do? Or do I need that Mars bar? What's the sugar doing? What's the carbohydrate doing? How do I feel after I've eaten it? What did it change inside in me? Am I happier now? Am I lower now? Do I feel fuller? Do I feel more empty? Sometimes it feels more empty. Lots of addicts will tell you it doesn't fill the emptiness anymore. So we need to investigate, what is the hunger? Now, this is where we get mostly into trouble. And when couples come for couples therapy, this is where they get seriously into trouble. This is where we get mostly into trouble with food as well. And that is that ability to make sensual contact with the environment. For example, most of us have probably never seen an animal being killed, have its throat cut, have its skinned, have its guts taken out. When was the last time you went out into the garden and dug up spuds or carrots or had a healthy contact with the earth? So you go to a supermarket and everything's wrapped in plastic. There's no contact with the fields anymore. There's no contact with the historical context in which this food comes out of and who we are. Because everything is either tinned or canned or it's wrapped up in plastic or in polythene. And so there's no contact to history. And there's no sensual contact. There's no smelling, touching, feeling. Well, now imagine if you couldn't do that with your partner. How would your relationship be? Pretty dull. Huh? So, we really need to get back to that. Well, what happens in our relationships, our everyday relationships? How is our sensual contact? How much do we touch? How much do we smell? Or are we all too busy to miss that part? This is the part that couples come. They say, we're not in contact anymore. He's working all the hours. I come home. For Christ, we've hardly time. Comes the weekend, I'm exhausted. And we're drifting this way. Well, we're very rich. And we're doing very well. And we have the nice house. So we need to look at this whole ability to make sensual contact. And then the intimacy. So, where do we make that intimate contact with food? Well, if we're not preparing it anymore, if we're just popping it into an oven, if there's no family contact where, you know, mom and dad and the kids are, you know, some of the kids are doing some of the peeling and the chopping and one of the lads is making the bread. We now come home and throw something quick into an oven and woof it down and gone. And on Sundays we're lucky to get an hour at the table. The family table doesn't have to be like the Waltons, lads. The greatest thing about the family table is the following. We're still here. We've come through all these other things. Yeah. We're still together as a unit. We still have a historical context in which we're all operating. Do you know? I can still listen to your stories. It's the same story I've heard. Oh, have you heard that one? Question. He's off again. Grandfather's telling that same fucking story about the war or whatever. Or she's still complaining about the same thing. But the good thing about it is that it's still happening. There's continuity and there's a sense of belonging. Now when the family table goes, we miss all that. And then we try and recreate it in all crazy sorts of ways by getting into all sorts of stuff, looking for that intimate contact. When there's no intimate contact with food, we're out of context completely. Or we go straight from hunger, come in the door starving, tough day in the office, we throw something in the oven, woof it down, have a shower, eat it, and we're out the door to a meeting like tonight. So we go straight from hunger to a simulation. But what you really need to take a look at is, does the way I relate to food parallel in any way? The question, just hang it up someplace. Is the way I eat my food similar to the way I relate to people? Do you go straight from hunger and into a simulation without first of all going through some sort of contact and some sort of intimate preparation? Now, a wonderful, wonderful man, if any of you work with people who have disabilities, anybody work with disability of any level? Arnie Weiser was a very famous American tennis player. He became one of the greatest, probably, I would say, psychiatrists that America had. Yeah? And he wrote a book called Flying Without Wings. He ended up, he was struck down with polio at 20, yet he was on the American tennis team. And he got struck down with polio. And he ended up in an iron lung. And he said it was only in the iron lung that he became aware that as a doctor, he had a body. And it was only when the nurses came to feed him that he realised he actually had taste. He said he was too busy to actually connect to body. And he wrote a very famous book called Flying Without Wings, and it talks about the paradoxical theory of change. When you accept what is, you're free. It's when you're fighting against it that the struggle is on. That's why I talk about when you accept the fat, you're free. When you accept your thinness, you're free then to have choices. It's when you're struggling to lose it and somebody said you have to lose it, you're telling them what they already know. The fight is on. Or you hear things like the war on drugs or the war on obesity. Well, what happens when there's a war? The other side sets up a higher resistance and the stakes get higher. So, Weiser said that the connections between food, earth and the cycles of weather are remote to the silly dweller other than a business abstraction. And he wrote that back in the 70s. And that's exactly what I would suggest to you is what food has now become. It has simply become a business transaction. I buy, I feed, I dispose. It's purely business. But there is no relationship in it anymore. So when we go to look at bulimia or anorexia or obsessive eating, like obsessive compulsive disorders or any of those, we need to look at the meaning behind the behaviour and not just the behaviour. So, I'm coming almost to the end. And I want just to say one or two other things in terms of this. There needs to be a paradoxical movement outwards for us to get back inwards. When you go home, I want you to question, how do I eat my food? How do I source it? How do I prepare it? What meaning does it have to me? Is it just food? Or is it something that gives me nourishment and sensual pleasure? Is it a way for me to make contact with my body? Or is it a way for me to disconnect from my body by staying full all the time? How much enjoyment do I get from food? The question is, what's my family table like now at home in my house? Is it like the family table I grew up in? What's different about my family table? Do the same rules apply? Are they different rules? Who sets the rules at my table? How do I self-sabotage myself every time the diet doesn't work? What I really want you to look at is, you all know what you do. But I want you to investigate, how do you do it? And what do you know about how you do it? Then you have information. And with the information, you have choice. What I really want to believe is that if we really want to get back into contact with food, we need to get back to Earth. And we need to get back into some sort of relational context with it, yeah? So, what I want to say is, I hope you've enjoyed tonight. I have a list here. If anybody's interested in the 2-day or 1-day experiential, I'm going to leave this on the table outside. Put your name on it. Yeah. Here, contact number, telephone number. If anybody has any questions, I'll answer a few questions if anybody's interested. Thanks a million. You've been fantastic.